Parents have been sold on a way to manage their children's behavior that neglects their attachment needs. Find out what Dr. Gordon Neufeld thinks about timeouts and disciplining your kids in part two of our interview this week on Family Anatomy.
Hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologist.
So if you need to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you could get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spizzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. You can find us over at familyanatomy.com or on iTunes, and we are going to get right into it tonight because we're going to hear part two of our interview with Dr. Gordon Neufeld.
The ophthalmologist.
Wow. That's a repeat of what we...
No, it was podiatrist last time. Oh, it was ophthalmologist this time.
2 weeks later, our listeners have probably forgotten, right?
Of course. He's not... either of those things. He's a psychologist.
Dr. Gordon Neufeld is a developmental psychologist. I'm just going to talk over you and just make sure that the message gets out there.
He's been in private practice in Vancouver for many years. He was a professor for 20 years at the University of British Columbia. He's written books. He was a forensic psychologist. But, you know, he's right now, he just came back from an international speaking tour. And we're happy to have the second part of our interview with Dr. Gordon Neufeld.
That's right. And tonight we're going to talk much more about how parents can deal with the problems that come up in day-to-day parenting existence. And this is kind of the hard stuff, right? We're going to be talking about what's the most difficult thing. Last time we were talking about maturing and connecting with your kids and things like that. But tonight we're going to get a bit more into what happens when kids get stuck in that maturation process.
That's right. I mean, I guess the same underlying theory is going to be at work here, but we're going to sort of take a look at when things aren't going well and how that's an important part of growing.
That's right. So let's get Dr. Neufeld on the line right away.
Let's do it. So parents might be doing the right thing to help their child mature, and they're connecting with them, and they're making them feel alive in their presence. But another thing about life is that there's unavoidable consequences to living that it means that there's going to be obstacles to their desires and to their growth. And so they'll have to learn that in some circumstances, you can't always get what you want. So dealing with obstacles to our desires is another central part of your understanding and practice, is it not?
Absolutely. As humans, we have the potential to be the most adaptive of all creatures. It's amazing what we can adapt to, lacks, losses, circumstances, and so on. But it's not automatic. It involves a process that is an emotional process and a very fragile process. And it means that we have to feel the futility of an endeavor. We have to actually experience coming up against something we cannot change. We have to actually, our emotional process has to, in a sense, cry uncle, in the sense that it says, you know, I can't change this. It's futile to try and get my way here. It's futile to try and push through. And so that has to sink in. And it's a very poignant emotional feeling that is required to drive this adaptive process.
And I think that this is probably one of the hardest things for parents, because we see our kids dealing with frustration. They're frustrated. They're upset. Well, we want to rescue them from that. We don't want them to feel that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's going to have an impact on that process.
Huge. And this is another place where we really need to trust in that developmental process. It's very hard to be an agent of futility for a child because you want to make things work for them. You know, you love them and so on. And it's very hard for today's parents to believe that, well, if I say no, which is the ultimate wall of futility, of course, if I say no or I represent futility, then they're going to be upset. And and that's difficult for us to do, yet it's absolutely essential for the adaptive process. But that's only half the story. The other part of the story is that the child has to feel futility. And for that, their heart has to be soft enough. And the indication in young children of when they feel futility is actually the tears of futility, the tears of sadness or disappointment. And so we have to make room for that as well and make it easy for them to have their tears over the things that they cannot change in their life if they're going to be as adaptive as they need to be in this world.
So I guess another thing that sticks out for me is the idea that, you know, we have to accept a certain amount of suffering and that somehow we've strayed away from that as a culture. And I know you were talking about in Europe, for instance, they have mazes, and this is a great metaphor for when you come up against obstacles and the idea that you need to be able to adapt to that. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yes, a sociologist, but the sense is that in North America, we were largely populated, at least the Caucasian part, those of us that came from Europe and have our roots in Europe, did come, many of our ancestors came fleeing suffering and in the hope that they would come to the land of promise where there was no suffering. And so this was institutionalized, of course, in the American Constitution in terms of the pursuit of happiness. And so we've lost our European sensibility that suffering is inevitable, it's part of life, it's unavoidable. And in fact, it's not the suffering itself, it's our response to it, is that there are many things we cannot change in life, many tragedies, many futilities, many things that are out of our control, but it's our own response, it's our own acute sadness and disappointment, it's our own feelings of futility that enable our adaptation to those things. And nowadays we talk in terms of neuroplasticity and of the brain to actually find workarounds and to be able to build other kinds of connections. And this is the neuroplasticity is the inward, the brain, in a sense, capacity. That's the that is the core key to this adaptive process. And we've lost this in North America as we've continue to try to avoid any suffering whatsoever. And this is certainly had its impact on child raising.
That's right. And sometimes those feelings of futility, that sadness is so threatening or so scary for kids or for their parents that they just become totally defended against it and they can't have those feelings anymore.
That's right. We're constantly saying to our children, don't be upset. There's no reason to be upset. We're trying to reason with them, rationalize them, with them and so on. Like when parents have got this, when they've really got it, I've had so many parents who have told me stories of their young children, their 4 and 5 and 6 year olds saying, oh, thank you, mommy. Thank you for letting me have my tears. that it feels so right for them to be able to actually have these tears. And they need to have these tears. My grandson, now approaching 10, but he was just 3 or 4 years of age, and he was having this interaction with his mother, my daughter, and he was pleading, but mommy, I haven't had all my tears yet. I still need some more tears. And there was the sense that they have when they're close to their intuition, that it's absolutely essential for them to be able to accept something that they can't change. The only way they can do this is through their tears.
And so, because if you're not doing that, I guess if you're not feeling the futility, if you're not having the tears, you keep banging your head against the same wall, trying to get through to something that's not going to happen. Once you have that feeling of futility and you have the tears, you can then redirect your energies to other solutions and other pathways.
Yes, it redirects automatically. It comes to what is called in physiology the still point. And it's that still point where something must end before something else begins and the energy is recycled. And what's so unique about this and so significant about this is that the brain also, once we come to this futility, conclusion is made that we have been able to survive not getting our way or not being able to change something. And so that this becomes key to a very deep and strong sense of resilience where things don't have to work for us. We know that we can handle things not working as well.
So we need these feelings of vulnerability. But on the other hand, I guess there's times where we can be overwhelmed by these feelings, and that's counterproductive as well.
Yes, that is, and that's the part where the parent is responsible for conveying that the child can indeed handle things. If the child loses confidence, if life is too much for them, then you have despair rather than acute feelings of sadness and disappointment. The hope is always there, and the confidence we want to convey that life is not too much for them, and so there is again a trust in the human process. That whatever happens, the things that we're out of control of, that there is the human capacity to adapt.
And so part of that, in the context of a secure attachment with a parent, you're less likely to get that despair.
That's right. That's precisely it. If the parent has good intuitions, good instincts about them, they know that they must their own fear where life is too much from the child. The child can't see it in their eyes. The child needs to be able to believe that they can cope.
But there's a risk here, right? If a child doesn't understand that something is futile, they might keep repeating the same things over and over and over again, trying to break through that barrier of futility, or they might lose confidence and start to feel that despair. And in either of those situations, they could become stuck.
Yes, and usually an indication of stuckness is a great deal of foul frustration, of attacking energy, and that's what seems to be absolutely escalating in our young children, is all of these indications of aggression, which is the result of the direct result of a lack of adaptation when we have not yet come to our tiers for us bigger children, for tears on the inside anyway, the things that we cannot change in our life. And you can actually feel this dynamic in you. I'm reaching 65 years of age, and I can feel this dynamic in me when I'm up against the things that I cannot change. And I have not yet come to terms with this. I can just feel the fight in me, feel the foul frustration, wanting to bite somebody's head off, the irritation, those things, and then you feel the softening when you finally experience the sadness and disappointment that needs to be there to keep you soft and to adapt to increasing number of things that you cannot change in your life.
And that's where, teachers and parents are seeing these stuck kids as having disruptive behavior problems or attention problems or problems with, there's all kinds of situations where these disorders are really about not adapting to something.
Absolutely. In fact, the 10 most common syndromes children are diagnosed with today have been called by some developmentalists the tearless syndromes. It's not that the lack of tears can cause the handicap, for instance, like blindness, but it was only when Helen Keller found her tears of futility did she become civilized and resilient and adaptive to her handicap.
So in schools, given we're talking about teachers and how they're dealing with kids at school, sometimes you'll get kids that are really shy. Like, they're not shy at home, they're talking at home, but they're so shy at school that they're not speaking to anyone. And the more traditional understanding of this is that they're too close with their parents, and they're so close with them that, for instance, they might be at school and needing to call their parent 3 or 4 times a day, and it's interfering with their functioning at school. How does a developmental approach deal with that kind of an issue?
Well, shyness is a very important indicator Shyness is a natural instinct, a natural attachment instinct. We're never shy with those we are attached. We only shy away from contact and closeness when outside of those attachments. And so the issue is not that children are too close to mom or fused with mom. The issue is that their village of attachment is not large enough. And so these shy children are not meant to function outside their village of attachment. In fact, children generally were not meant to visit, to no more than our pets are meant to function outside of their villages of attachment. Our problem is that we are the smallest nuclear family ever in the history of humanity, and many of us have lost our extended families, and children no longer have the villages of attachment that are required for them to be able to be raised without this shyness dumbing them down and crippling them. And so the issue is the other way. It's not to get rid of shyness, it's to see shyness as an indicator in our society that the child's village is not large enough. It means that mom and whoever the child is attached to, not shy with, needs to take some initiative to build relationships, to match make the child with others, to increase their the child's attachments with the adults who need to take care of them. And we need, as a society, to support that. We need as schools to support that. We don't support that. We don't even put the mother in the lead in this way to be able to cultivate the attachments the child needs.
So really, it's about forming new relationships or facilitating the child's ability to form new relationships with people outside of the home.
Absolutely. Over the years, I've dealt probably with 20, 30 cases of what's called elective or selective mutism, where a child only won't talk to anybody in school. This is often, first of all, realized in school. The child is in grade 3 or grade 4, doesn't talk to anybody in school. And almost two to one, when I have queried about it, who does the child talk to? Well, only to his mother. Well, of course, that's the child is very shy. The problem is the child is only attached to the mother, and so the child, we don't need to send this child out for speech therapy. We need to be able to cultivate the attachments this child needs.
But like you say, that's not necessarily the first thing that a parent or a medical doctor or a teacher is going to think of. Medication maybe is the first thing that people think of when they see these kinds of problems. And that doesn't sound like something that can help a kid become unstuck.
Oh, and that's very unfortunate, because in the medical world, shyness is seen as a social anxiety disorder, and it's actually pathologized. So yes, the first issue is that something is wrong with the child. They're showing social anxiety rather than no, the brain is doing what is deemed best for the child, and the child isn't meant to function outside of attachment. So yes, you're right. Many parents are ashamed of their shy children and don't realize that this is an indicator that we should listen to. We should read shyness, and it's telling us that the child needs more attachments in order to function.
So we're talking a lot about attachments, and I know there's a lot of parents listening out there that use timeouts with their kids to try and get them to comply, to make them do something they want to see them do and prefer them do, and get them to stop things that they're doing that they don't like. What do you think about timeouts, and how does attachment inform that?
Well, the timeouts were not informed by attachment theory, of course, which was very unfortunate. The American Pediatric Association in the 1996, and the Canadians followed it in 1998. They were commissioned to be able to educate parents to have something alternate to the spanking, to replace the spanking, and so it was thought that timeouts were benign, and that this would actually save the child from a frustrated parent. And so the whole issue was just to get parents to stop hitting their children. And it is true that when you send the child to their room, it's always better to send them to their room than to kill the child. That definitely is true. And so relatively speaking, it was right, but unfortunately it was uninformed. You know, it was uninformed that their greatest fear, our greatest fear as humans, is separation. And our greatest trauma is separation. And now we can actually measure in swabs the cortisol level, the saliva, and know that when a child is facing separation, the cortisol levels spike high. And so what we're using against a child is actually the thing that is most alarming to them. And so it works in the sense that it knee-jerks them into, initially, it knee-jerks them into a situation where they're desperately trying to be good. It's just like when you have a three-year-old and you're trying to get them to come away from the playground. And they're refusing, and so you say bye-bye, and you act as if you're going to disappear. And what happens is, in facing the separation, it triggers very high pursuit in the child, and so that you get them coming. It also triggers, at the very same time, high alarm, which causes insecurity and anxiety, and it triggers frustration, which will most likely cause some aggression later on. But we don't see that. We just see the pursuit. And so this is one of the most uninformed interventions ever. And now it's becoming ubiquitous in the sense that it's getting close to a majority of parents, young parents, are actually using this as a means of trying to control the behavior of their children without realizing that when they are doing so, they are not only pushing emotional buttons in a child, as well as provoking defense. That is, when being close to somebody sets you up for being hurt, the brain has a mechanism, it's called defensive detachment, to resist contact and closeness. And so it can actually hinder the development of the relationship. And the relationship is what we need. We need the child to be able to fall deeply into attachment with us, to be emotionally connected. And they're not going to do this when we use the relationship against them. This is something that should be sacred. The whole issue of security is that a child can feel as if there's nothing that could separate us from our love. Absolutely nothing. And they need to know more than ever when behavior has come in the way that the relationship can survive it. And so the symbol of that is. You know, it's the opposite of saying to them, get out of my sight until you can behave, get to your room, which is withdrawing the invitation to exist in one's presence until they behave. It's the opposite message that we need to give to them, and so that they understand that the relationship is the bottom line.
So timeouts and sending kids to their room is setting off all of the alarm bells and creating lots of stress that might cause long-term problems down the road. Well, but how do parents manage kids whose behavior is so difficult?
Well, first of all, it's knowing that most of the behavior has an emotional root, and it can't be addressed or fixed in the situation. Much of the issues are developmental in nature. And they're being emotionally determined. Most of the stuff the child isn't doing on purpose. There has to be some patience with this, but we've had all kinds of ways of being able to deal with this before. Our parents would have gone in the room with the child instead of sending them alone. This again is better, of course, unless you don't have your own emotions in control, in check, and then that wouldn't be advised. But if that isn't the issue, then certainly that would be important. The primary problem today is that parents have been fed the idea that that a child can control their behavior, and that therefore they must teach them a lesson. And that has meant the incident to be the primary focal point of discipline, and where you try to give change. And of course, the incident is not the place to try and deal with problems. That's generally the place. That's not the place you can access the problem properly. The emotions are too high. The defensiveness is too much. Creativity of the parent is too low. But we live by the rules, the learning principles of immediacy and consistency. And so immediacy means that you get on top of it right away. And so the pressure is on the incident. Where from a developmentalist point of view, the issue is growth, not behavior, and behavior will straighten itself out as potential is realized. But there's nothing you can do in an incident to make a geranium grow up. Absolutely nothing. You have to create the conditions that are conducive for it. Everything will straighten out. The dream will realize its potential. But this isn't done in an instant, and it's not done in an incident.
So another thing that parents do is they'll threaten to take away a prized possession that the child has. How do you feel about that technique?
Well, it's used as a threat. What we're using is what a child cares about against them. Not advisable to use that as a policy, because when you use what children care about against them, you're very quickly courting the defensive instinct not to care. And that's what we're hearing in our society today, a chorus of children saying, I don't care, doesn't matter, whatever. There's a flight from vulnerability. And so this is not advisable. Now, when I say that, I don't mean that a parent isn't responsible for taking away things that are being misused or where a child is going to hurt themselves, but that's a parent being responsible. That's not to teach the child a lesson. That's simply to be responsible as a parent. But when a parent is finding themselves actually looking around for what a child cares about so that they have some power over the child, that's not good. The child is going to experience that parent as being against them rather than for them, and you can't really help a child who thinks that you're against them. There's no way you can. Conditions there for their true growth. It's a very cynical process. Whereby you're trading on their attachment to things when you really should be believing that their attachment to you, to us as parents, is enough to be able to do what we need to do.
So really, what's happening there then is that you're potentially hurting them in a way that makes them shut themselves down to their own feelings and to others. And once you've shut those feelings down, they no longer are accessible. Those vulnerable feelings aren't accessible, that don't allow, and that's what you need to be able to adapt and to get over different obstacles in life.
Yeah, well said. Absolutely well said. The most important thing we understand now is not behavior, but a soft heart. A child needs a healthy limbic system, if we're going to use scientific language, where they can feel all their emotions. And that is most significant for growth. It's the limbic system that's even in charge of the development of the brain. And so we have been putting way too much focus on behavior and not nearly enough focus on healthy emotion. And we are doing things in our timeouts. We're doing things in our using what children care about against them to actually harden our children's hearts, to court emotional defensiveness and desensitization. And this is what's arresting their development and causing the very problems then that we seek more desperate measures to fix.
And some of those parents who are using those techniques are going to listen to this and say, but you're taking away all my power. How will I have any authority over my kids if this is what we do?
All the power that is needed, it comes naturally in the relationship. If we work at that relationship, if a child properly attaches to us deeply and vulnerably, there is a natural power that we never have to draw attention to. It just is there, and the child's natural desire to be good. I have in my book a chapter of, just because of what you said, you get this deer caught in the headlights kind of look and say, you're taking everything away from me. I don't know what's left, you know. And I included a chapter in the book just for that on seven disciplines that don't divide. Just to say, well, come on, these are just things that we've drifted to in the last generation. There are much more effective disciplines that have been around since for ages that are attachment friendly, developmentally friendly, attachment safe. And, structure, ritual, soliciting good intentions, cultivating mixed feelings. There are so many things that we can use that are far more effective than what we've tended to do today is use what children care against them and send them to their room. We have not evolved properly in terms of our parenting at all.
Well, listen, I think we've come to the end of our time, and we really thank you for joining us today, Dr. Neufeld. It's been a very interesting discussion, and I'm sure our listeners will enjoy listening to this.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you so much. And we will see you in February when you come to the Ottawa area for your talk.
I look forward to it.
And if people want to know more about your work and your material and books, where can they go on the web?
The easiest way to do it is just to go to Neufeld Institute, N-E-U-F-E-L-D, institute.com, www.neufeldinstitute.com. And there's a speaking schedule. The Ottawa events are there as well as the description of the approach and so on.
Perfect. Well, happy birthday, and we'll see you in February.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's the end of part two of our interview with Dr. Gordon Neufeld. I hope you all enjoyed that. I know we did. You can visit us at familyanatomy.com or you can email us at info@familyanatomy.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. And as usual, we will leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love, and he's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening.
See you in 2 weeks. So get up and sing. It's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do. FamilyAnatomy.com